Welcome to the PHADH Weekly COVID-19 Conference Call. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 using your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. And now, I would like to turn the call over to Amelia Keaton. You may begin.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Amelia Keaton with the Tennessee Department of Health. I am joined today by Dr. Mary Margaret Still. We're just going to be giving some brief updates and then hopefully allow plenty of time for questions for folks on the line at acute care hospitals and long-term care facilities and public health.
Hi, good morning, everybody. We just wanted to start with a few updates. I don't know that we have too many today, but I first just wanted to make sure that everyone was aware of some additional guidance and information that's on our website, as well as give a little bit of context for some of the numbers that we're publicly reporting. So first, as I'm sure everyone is aware, you know, we're updating our case counts on the website at 2 p.m. daily. I think first I do want to address, because I realize there has been a lot of conversation about this in the media and in different communities, I think it's important to note that we are counting cases in Tennessee at the statewide level a little bit differently than some of the large metro jurisdictions are counting in their area. So I want you guys to all have some context for those differences. As you probably have noticed, we have a category of cases in the county breakdown that's out of Tennessee. We are basically classifying cases by their county of permanent residence. And so if cases are out of Tennessee residents, even if they may still be in Tennessee, they are not necessarily captured in the county where they're spending their time. They're captured in that out-of-Tennessee bucket. And that's really just because for us at the state level with, you know, now approaching 1,000 cases, it's really challenging for us to track that real-time patient location information and much more reliable for us to capture patients' county of residence. However, the metros appropriately and understandably are often releasing numbers including individuals who may be non-Tennessee residents but who are staying in their area or who are tested in their area that they may be doing follow-up contact tracing and daily active monitoring on. So, again, I just wanted to give a little bit of context for some of those differences because I realize there's been a lot of questions around them. I think some of those differences will likely persist. We're working with our partners and in the jurisdictions that are releasing their own numbers to try to see if we can all release things in a way that is a little more clear for the public, but we certainly wanted to be sure that our healthcare partners had that understanding. I also want to bring your attention to the fact that we've started reporting hospitalizations on our website. So this number is really just a rough indicator of the proportion of all of our patients that have required hospitalization. So this is it's a question that's asked on that CDC PUI form. It's a question that our public health investigators ask when they contact patients or clinicians to do the initial public health interview. It's just a yes-no, generally one point in time question that is asked. There is certainly a chance that patients who are initially well and at home, but who may require hospitalization later in their illness may not be captured through this mechanism. But again, it's just meant to be a rough estimate of the proportion of patients that are hospitalized. We do not plan to release in any further granular detail the number of hospitalizations or the number of fatalities, other than just sharing them at the statewide level. And again, just meant to be a metric of, potentially disease severity, not meant to be a real-time indicator of potential healthcare system strain, or the number of patients hospitalized at any given point in time. So hopefully that provides a little bit of clarity. There are some caveats in language on the website, but again, we realize that you guys are probably getting questions about this, and so as we add these data points, we want to be sure that you understand the source of that information and really what they're meant to represent. There has also been a whole host of additional guidance added to the website. We're trying to do a really good job of doing at least a weekly audit of the data, the guidance and documents that we have available for use in all of those different categories. And so certainly, you know, please, if you notice a document that's out of date, you know, please don't hesitate to reach out, and we're happy to ensure that it's updated, but we are constantly adding and updating and refreshing. So hopefully those resources have been helpful for you at various points in time. I think this may have been mentioned last week, but I do want to just bring your attention to a couple of documents that are in the For the Public tab. And this is information that could be helpful for clinicians as they are diagnosing patients with COVID-19. You know, we are still doing a public health interview with every case. In the vast majority of areas of the state, we are still doing contact tracing for all of those cases. But we realize there might be a delay in time, especially as more commercial laboratories are testing, as hospitals are testing. Occasionally there's a lag of a couple of days from when that test result comes back until when public health investigators are able to contact the patient. So that often that first communication, rightfully so, is between the clinician and the patient that they're treating. But we realize that patients may have questions about, aside from their health status and what it means for their health and the future of their health, questions about what this diagnosis means for them in terms of activity restrictions and their family and their work and those sorts of things. And so there are a couple of guidance documents. The first is entitled What to Expect After Being Diagnosed, and the other is What to Expect If You Were Possibly Exposed. So those are meant to be information for both cases and then contacts of cases. We're happy for you to share those. We want them to be widely shared with the public so that people know what to expect before they're potentially contacted by public health. There is a third document, What to Expect After Being Tested, which is probably most helpful, you know, in our outpatient clinics and settings, just setting expectations, especially in the often delays that come with testing results, to ensure that people understand the expectations that they stay home while they're waiting on their test results. So those are all there. We can certainly share those links more specifically with Dr. Long and others with THA after the webinar for those to be sent out in an email, if that would be helpful to ensure that folks have those links readily available. But we do think those are helpful for people. A couple of other points. I know that our healthcare-associated infections team has done a number of webinars recently targeted to infection preventionists and infection control and hospitals, as well as some targeted outreach with long-term care facilities. I know at a minimum the infection control webinars have been recorded, and so we're working on getting those posted on the website for folks that were not able to join in real time. That way that information and those resources are available. There was also a CDC COCA call about PPE conservation guidance, and those are always recorded for you to watch after the fact, and we're, again, happy to share the link to that if people want to access that and watch that, get that information from CDC from that call that happened, I think, on, I don't know what day of the week it was, Wednesday, yes, thank you, happened on Wednesday this week. Otherwise, hopefully all of you have been in communication with partners in your healthcare coalitions in the area that you are in. There was information that went out over the weekend and early this week about PPE distribution from the Strategic National Stockpile. Those items of PPE have been pushed out to the coalitions, the 8 coalitions across the state, and then will be distributed further through those groups, through the mechanisms that they have established with the coalition members. So if you have not heard outreach about that, please reach out to your local healthcare coalition to get more information about that process. And then I wanted to just mention two other things about sort of data and tracking. You know, many of you are participating daily in our healthcare resource tracking system, the HERT system, where we track bed availability and ICU bed availability and ventilator availability. You know, we have recently in the last 10 days or so added metrics asking about specific PPE availability, and we've been working closely with Dr. Long and others at THA to add potentially some additional metrics around critical shortages of PPE, as well as the current number of patients with COVID-19 hospitalized in facilities, trying to get a better assessment of that in real time, because we realize that we don't really have a great way right now to determine how many patients are admitted in each facility across the state, and using this daily update system that every hospital already has access to is a potential great way to capture that resource in real time. So I guess first, just we greatly appreciate everyone that's participating. We know that it's often yet another thing on a list of many things to do that everyone has to do that day to go in and enter that information, but please know that these data are being used in real time and by the coalitions and certainly by leadership at the state level as we look at future surge planning and resource allocation. And to the degree that we can have as complete and up-to-date information in there as possible is hugely beneficial for us as we try to determine how we can best assist all of you in the future as things continue to evolve. So first, just a plug to continue to participate in HERTS and a thank you for all of you that are doing so so regularly. I will also mention for the infection preventionists on the phone, there is another surveillance system that CDC operates called the National Healthcare Safety Network, where we collect information about healthcare-associated infections and other similar data points. We've gotten some preliminary information that they're going to be adding a module to NHSN that may look to collect some of this similar information about beds and vents and COVID-19 patients in the facility. You know, we certainly want to be thoughtful about people's time and since we often have to report information in multiple ways, we certainly don't want to overburden you with having to report information in multiple ways. So we're going to try to better understand exactly what NHSN is asking for, and then we will provide additional updates as we clarify what information they're looking to collect. And as we finalize the information that we're going to be collecting in HERTS to ensure that we're not asking folks to do double duty, because I don't think, given how busy we all are, we want to be really thoughtful about what we're asking people to do. So if you see any information about that, we will circle back and of course, communicate directly with the infection preventionists that most often work in NHSN to be sure that they understand what the expectations are. So we just wanted to give you a heads up about that.
Yep, and this is Amelia Keaton with the Healthcare Associated Infections team. We assumed that there would likely be some kind of COVID-19 module put into NHSN, but we received, I think, the email probably at the same time that you all did about the elements that would be included within that. And so, we are still trying to hash out what the details are. We promise we'll share those as we get them, But I think this is new to us, and we will certainly make sure that once we have more information, we'll try to provide more complete guidance to you all on that. For a few other things that I was just going to touch base on from our side of the shop, so we tried to release some new documents this week on our website regarding PPE conservation. We know there's a lot of guidance out there from CDC and some other professional societies, so we tried to distill that to the degree possible into one-pagers. We also presented some of this information on the webinars we provided earlier this week for acute care hospitals and then one yesterday for long-term care facilities. But I urge you all to take a look at those if PPE shortages and reuse and extended use of those items are something that's happening in your facility. We also created a new document for what healthcare workers should do if they test positive, and then also steps for the healthcare facility where positive healthcare workers may be employed to do. That's on the website. Again, that's another one-pager, but I think something that is increasingly coming to our attention, and I'm sure is already at your attention, as we try to maintain our healthcare worker workforce. So some of the important things to note there, any employees who are symptomatic, you know, either with respiratory symptoms or any other signs of illness, ideally should be staying at home. And I think in those situations, if they do have symptoms that would be consistent with COVID-19, I think it's even more imperative that they get testing for that. We are still trying to make sure that we prioritize those types of specimens at our state labs, so just please work with us to get those specimens over, and we'll try to get those tested for you because we know that helps guide contact tracing and other interventions within your facility. For asymptomatic healthcare workers who might have been exposed to either a patient or a coworker who have COVID-19, again, ideally those individuals would stay home to monitor for symptoms. We know that that's not possible as we have increased numbers of exposures. And so another option that CDC has endorsed and that we've also tried to include in our guidance are for these healthcare workers to continue to work but to have active symptom monitoring at least once during their shift. And also that all of these potentially exposed employees wear surgical masks for the entirety of their shift, just in the event that they are either asymptomatically shedding viruses or they have mild, non-specific symptoms that may be related to COVID-19 but that aren't recognized as being related to COVID-19 at the time. Obviously, if any of those exposed healthcare workers become symptomatic and recognize that, they should immediately stop working and go home. I think from our side of things, again, I know Dr. Phil mentioned that we had had two webinars earlier this week. We're working on getting those processed and available to you all. One was sponsored by the Tennessee Hospital Association, and they should have access to those slides and the recording. I believe those have been sent out. We did one yesterday specifically targeted to long-term care facilities. We're working with, that was one that we did here on our own system, and so we're still working on that as well. And then I think finally something that we wanted to bring up is that we know that acute care hospitals have had some issues trying to transfer patients to long-term care facilities and to other facilities after they've recovered from their acute illness. That is something that should not require repeat testing in those cases. That certainly should not be the expectation. We're trying to make sure we get that messaging out to our long-term and rehabilitational facilities. You know, a lot of times these patients may still require isolation precautions or contact and droplet precautions, but those should be something that most facilities can handle. So we hear you on that one, and we're trying to do our part to clarify any messaging there. And I think that's it from the healthcare-associated infections side.
How much? This is Tim Jones. Sorry, hold on. How much did you talk about the request for supply communication line?
I didn't.
Okay, sorry. This is Tim Jones. Couple quick things. And you all hopefully have heard a lot about this before. One is just a reminder that the supplies that went out to hospitals via healthcare coalitions, which I think every hospital in the state has been involved in those discussions with the healthcare coalition, include supplies that might go out to assessment facilities that are under the wing of hospitals. So we don't have any other supplies to separately give to assessment facilities, you know, that may be sponsored or that are in cooperation between hospitals or anything like that. And we are still getting some requests for supplies, you know, directly from these assessment sites, and just want to make sure that they know, that you know, that any supplies that we had available went through the healthcare coalitions. And I think we mentioned that before. And then the last thing in terms of supply chain, since we're out, what we had is going out to the healthcare coalition. CHEMA is essentially taking over the role of collecting and distributing supplies, and that includes PPE and test collection material as well. So anyone who has in need, and that can be a local doc in your community, a nursing home, an assessment facility, and hospital, should make those requests through your local EMA agency. They will then send them up through the chain to CHEMA, which is keeping a list of needs and potential suppliers and material that they may be already receiving. And then they will match those up, you know, based on priority lists and get them out. But it's kind of frustrating to once again tell folks, sorry, call EMA, but that's just the communication message up and sort of the National Guard EMA group is the one that now they will know what's available, where it is in the state, who needs it, and who gets it. And that's all we'll be able to tell folks if they call Dr. Phil or Dr. Keaton down in our op center. So if you could just help get that message out, that would be great.
All right, I think those are the big updates that we wanted to share. So we will stop blabbing and open the line for questions and happy to try to address anything that we can.
Thank you. Okay. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star 1 using your touchtone phone. You can cancel your request by pressing the pound sign or the hash key. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, for any questions, please press star 1. We're standing by for questions. We have a question from Lynn Lancaster. Please go ahead.
Yes, two things. I'm glad you covered that about nursing homes. Over the last 2 days, I've had people admitted to the hospital non-related to COVID that nursing home or long-term care are denying until they have a test. And then also mass disinfection. Just your thoughts on using UV light to extend that or the new thing with Duke, the aerosolized hydrogen peroxide.
So this is Amelia Keaton. So I think different facilities are either doing or have done studies with specific UV light systems and the hydrogen peroxide systems that you've mentioned. I don't know if we've received formal guidance from CDC or some of the other sources, but I think, there is certainly promising data, just at this point probably not one that not a specific system or protocol that we're able to provide, but I think we hope that more information on those is forthcoming so that we can make more formal recommendations.
Yeah, and this is Dr. Phil. I can say that, I know that the folks that run the biocontainment unit at the University of Nebraska have developed a protocol for N95 decontamination with UV. Obviously it's not a formal CDC or WHO guidance or recommendation, but I do know that other acute care hospitals in the state are using that protocol, and it's something that's, fairly easy to find, and I think certainly from a reputable source. I mean, they have done a lot of work in this area.
Yeah, but I will just also kind of add the caveat that a lot of those studies are on specific UV light systems, and so I think it's hard to know at this point how generalizable those are to other systems, to keep in mind.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Chris Long.
Yes, could you just repeat the website where we can get the recommendation for healthcare workers who have been exposed to patients under investigation or positive COVID-19?
Sure. It's on our website. So if you just go to tn.gov/health, there's a big banner bar in yellow that says Tennessee Department of Health coronavirus information. It's under the tab towards the bottom for healthcare workers. However, I'm also putting together a list of resources that we've already mentioned on the call to share with CHA, and they can also push that out by email.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Once again, for any questions, please press star 1. The next question comes from Susan Cooper.
Hey, good morning, everyone. There seems to be some confusion around healthcare providers who have been have a positive diagnosis of COVID and the requirement for 2 successive swabs before they can come back to work 24 hours apart. Can you comment on that?
So CDC on their website has a return. They have a nice return to work page outlining criteria for healthcare providers with confirmed or suspected COVID-19. There is both a test-based and a non-test-based strategy. So, there's no requirement from CDC or from the Department of Health that healthcare workers have 2 negative tests 24 hours apart. We are supportive of the non-test-based strategy, which basically recommends that people be excluded from work until they have had at least 72 hours of full recovery, so resolution of fever without any fever-reducing medications and improvement in their respiratory symptoms, and at least 7 days since their symptoms first started. So it's similar as to what we recommend for non-healthcare providers, but basically, you know, it's going to be a minimum of 7 days out of work, and they have to be feeling better and afebrile for at least 72 hours. So it could be longer than 7 days, depending on that symptom resolution piece.
Okay, thank you.
We have a question from Dr. Mark Brent.
It's Mark Brown, sorry. Thanks again for having these calls. Any update on the email communication, Dr. Phil, that you sent out yesterday regarding Integrity Labs?
Yeah, I don't think we have any update. I can, you know, again, that information was shared just to try to make sure that public health and healthcare partners had awareness of the situation. I know that our state public health laboratory has had some communication with them, and at this point, it's really up to Integrity to communicate with FDA and determine their most appropriate next steps. And I believe that communication is happening, but we are not. We don't have regulatory authority there. We are not in the middle of it. It's between FDA and Integrity at this point.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yep.
Once again, for any questions, please press star 1. The next question comes from Jennifer.
Yes. Can you explain again the out of Tennessee results? Because it just makes it appear that there's so many more positives in the state of Tennessee by having that data on there.
Yeah, so, you know, the confusion is that these are patients that most, if not all of whom, were tested in Tennessee. So they either, you know, we are a state that has many borders, so in some instances this is a Mississippi resident that receives their health care in Memphis and so went there to be tested. Because they were tested in Tennessee, those results were reported to us. However, they may be then returned home to Mississippi and will complete their isolation period and receive any health care there. The other situation is where we have, you know, college students or tourists or traveling musicians, or I'm trying to think of some of the other examples I know of, where people are permanent residents in another area, but they, for all intents and purposes, either temporarily or permanently live in Tennessee for the time, at least while they've been tested and are receiving health care and while they're under isolation. So, you know, their permanent residence may be outside of Tennessee, but they may be here for an extended period of time, and this is where they're getting their care and where the follow-up with public health is happening. So because in our surveillance systems, we don't have really a systematic way to sort of capture that nuance between those two scenarios, We at the state level classify people based on where their permanent address is. So if they are a permanent resident of Ohio, but they were, I'm using this as an example, not a real scenario, a Vanderbilt student and were diagnosed here and received their care here, we would still count them as an out-of-Tennessee resident. However, Metro Nashville might be including them in their numbers that they're reporting because they're doing all of the follow-up with them. And some of that is just that those numbers and the nuanced details about each investigation is much more available to people at the local level. Appropriately, they're the ones that are doing all the work. So we're just trying to be as systematic as possible so that we can ensure that even though our numbers might be slightly different, as I said, from the metros, we want to be sure that we're counting people the same way. And I will also say, you know, we collect surveillance information for all kinds of diseases, not just for coronavirus. And this protocol and procedure of capturing people by their permanent residence is how we handle every single other reportable disease that we track. So this is sort of the standard approach. This situation is a little bit unique, and that's why we're seeing, again, the local health department sometimes report their numbers a little bit differently, again, which is appropriate given the amount of work that they're doing for these cases. It just, we understand that it creates a little bit of confusion.
Okay. That makes sense.
The next question comes from the West Tennessee Healthcare team.
Yes, good morning. My question is back to PPE and the gowns. And I noticed on the TDH site, they have the same language about gowns that say consider extending the use for healthcare providers without changing the gown between patients who have the same infectious disease diagnosis or exposure and are maintained in a confined area. And we're really going back and forth between that because we are really trying to conserve the stock we have now, you know, considering that we're expecting more patients to come. And if we go through that volume that would require to change that gown every single time, right now we have 20 patients on our floor that's a segregated floor. Can you clarify what these staff should be doing? Because we're really, you know, we're trying to conserve what we have because that is one item that we're not seeing come back across on our supply chain. Thank you.
Yeah, hi. So I think, you know, one thing that I'll start with is that, you know, this is really our first experience with such a widespread shortage of all elements of PPE. And so a lot of the guidance we have is still in process and still in flux. What I will say is that, you know, the overall purpose of an isolation gown is to prevent splashes and contamination from a patient to a healthcare worker. And so, you know, that with that goal in mind, I think it would be difficult to use those gowns on multiple patients if you don't know their COVID-19 status. So the question that I took yesterday that's similar to this one referred to patients who were diagnosed with COVID-19 and those who were under suspicion, but the diagnosis wasn't confirmed yet. And so I think where you could get into trouble is if you're using those gowns on the confirmed patients and then going into a different patient room where that patient may not have COVID-19. I think by doing that, you also, you know, obviously increase the risk that a healthcare worker will touch the gown and then touch their face. And so, I think we don't have great guidance, unfortunately, on what to do in those situations. I think, obviously, cohorting patients and healthcare workers is a great idea. And I think if you have patients who do have, the same known diagnosis, then the risk is much lower. But if you have a mixed patient population, I think you run the risk of exposing patients who may not have COVID-19 being exposed to it. And also, it just increases the risk to the healthcare worker that they may, self-inoculate themselves as well. CDC, I think, has tried to put together some guidance on other options for places that are running out of the disposable hospital gowns, the disposable isolation gowns, so things like disposable lab coats, disposable aprons, washable patient hospital gowns, those kinds of things. Just trying to keep in mind, you know, the intended purpose of that and know that, you know, a lot of places are running out of those isolation gowns. So I hope that helps. It's kind of a long-winded answer. But I think it does get difficult. And just like you all, this is something we're still trying to think through fully before we make more definitive recommendations.
Thank you. We have a question from Dr. Mark Brown. Please go ahead.
Hey, it's Dr. Brown again. Can you revisit for us, please, the long-term care and nursing home piece of this? We're seeing this in our community as well, and here at Covenant, I'm kind of both sides of the equation because we have SNFs, we have a rehab hospital, we also have acute care hospitals, and, you know, in talking to my folks from my SNFs and from our rehab hospital, you know, we've got visitor restrictions that are incredibly restrictive, and we want sick healthcare workers to go home, yet you want us to take potential COVID patients or patients who are sick and may have COVID, or even positive COVID patients. Even the CDC guidance, I've read it multiple times, is not really clear on who should be transferred and when. And I've heard a lot about, well, it doesn't require this, but is there any way that the Department of Health could provide some clarifying, consistent guidance for all long-term care facilities across the state so we can have some consistency? Because in deference to our SNF folks, they're obviously very concerned about having any possible exposure to the point that we're limiting everybody to come in, yet we want to transfer some sick patients to them. We're going to need to transfer some sick patients to them. Right now, the guidance to me is confusing, and I don't think I'm alone. Is there any way you could provide some clarifying guidance formally in writing?
So, Dr. Phillips will answer this question, but are you saying that there are people that you're being asked to bring infectious COVID patients into your facility?
We haven't yet because I'm in Knox County. We don't have a huge penetrance yet, but I think that's a concern. But there right now it's more the SNFs and the rehab hospitals saying they want to have a high level of certainty of negativity, particularly for anybody who may have been in an acute care setting, because we have pending patients and, you know, and we're doing all the infection prevention things, et cetera. But the nursing homes, as we all know, are nervous. They have very high-risk populations, and the guidance of everybody following the same guidance of this is what we require before transfer, I'm hearing a lot of it in the negative. You don't need to have a test, but please use your clinical judgment. And there's so many different clinical scenarios, I understand. That's one part of this, of our flow, and I've been talking about this with my friends over at UT as well. We're still not entirely consistent. I know in our community, I don't know if we're seeing it in other communities across the state as well. So looking for more definitive guidance.
Yeah, I mean, we cannot write guidance that forces nursing homes to take anybody. We can, you know, I think Dr. Phil mentioned earlier, we can recommend. I think the most important thing, you know, it's not surprising at all that a nursing home or, you know, extended care facility would want evidence that a patient coming in is not infectious. So clearly they should, now one way that they may demand that would be with negative tests. We're not recommending that, as Dr. Phil said, but they also need to know that patients that are fitting the criteria that Dr. Phil mentioned, which is 7 days after their diagnosis plus 72 hours of having no symptoms, so minimum of 7 days. What? You finished the sentence. But that you don't, there are other ways to not be infectious or to demonstrate non-infectivity besides negative testing. And we can recommend those things, but we cannot require any facility that we can't set criteria that requires them to accept. Sorry, Dr. Phil.
Yeah, I think, Dr. Brown, I'm not sure that I'm going to have an amazing answer for you. I think we certainly recognize the complexity of the situation. It's really a push-pull of we want to be able to efficiently move patients out of our acute care hospitals and be thoughtful of occupancy status there, but we certainly don't want to knowingly or potentially put a long-term care facility or a SNF at risk by moving a patient there that could be harboring the virus and create a bigger problem. So we certainly understand the tension between those two factors. And I think we also fully recognize that our ongoing limitations in sort of very timely testing also are contributing to this challenge. Because if it was possible to easily get negative testing, although that's not, as we've said, you know, what we have uniformly recommended in any stance, but if that was a possibility, we understood that certainly could provide some reassurance, but that capacity is just not there right now. So, we've mentioned this to CDC several times. We know this is a challenge at the national level, and so it's been a couple of days since we've circled back on this ask and also to try to better learn from our partners in other states. And so we're happy to re-ping CDC and our other state health departments to try to understand and learn if there have been any mechanisms that they have developed that have seemed to help with that flow, but while also protecting the health and safety of patients in long-term care facilities and skilled nursing facilities. So a sort of a non-answer, except to say that we understand that this is a huge issue and a challenge, and we see both sides clearly, and we're happy to do our very best to try to troubleshoot and see if other states have come up with some mechanisms or algorithms that have worked well for them, and then circle back.
That would be helpful. Thank you. Appreciate it, Dr. Phil.
The next question comes from Stacy. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I was wondering, I am a infection preventionist at a freestanding site facility in Memphis. We're a 350-bed facility. I was wondering if there is any guidance or recommendations coming out specifically for sites, because we are milieu-based and our patients are all roaming around the unit. We have five right now who we have sent out for testing, who, of course, were sent right back to us, and that's our challenge, is what do we do with those patients? We're isolating them as much as possible, but it's a big challenge for us.
Yeah, we at this point don't have specific guidance for behavioral health facilities, although I think a lot of the guidance that is given to the general community would apply here, so trying to avoid any congregate settings. You know, I know how important those are to mental health and, you know, rehabilitation, but I think we are in extreme and unprecedented circumstances, and so trying to limit those communal activities as much as possible, I think would be the overarching recommendation there. I think paying increased attention to environmental services, so making sure that you have healthcare-appropriate disinfectants, that you're able to clean those areas that might be frequented by multiple people at the same time. But I do think that that is a very important need and something that we can certainly try to look into some more formal guidance for you all, because, you know, again, we know that it's a very unique situation and it's not really something that can equate easily to things like acute care hospitals or to long-term care facilities, and so we'll certainly look into that.
Thank you. It's just very hard to keep 70 psychotic patients in their room and not in a group, so it's a challenge. Thank you.
The next question comes from Melanie. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having this weekly call. As the infection preventionist for a large oncology outpatient center, we have screeners at the doorway. I'm getting quite a bit of pushback about these screeners not wearing masks, which is the recommendation from our medical staff. Most of this is because we have found that some of the patients are being disingenuous about their symptoms because they are fearful that they will not be seen if they tell the truth. How do I deal with this, or should we begin masking our screeners? Thank you.
So I think we, you know, under regular circumstances would not recommend that screeners in your lobby wear masks. I think we are in unusual circumstances, and I think if that's something that makes people feel more comfortable and you have the supplies, that's something that you consider. I know some other facilities were trying to do other engineering controls, like, you know, having their screeners sit behind a window or maybe have patients call before they get to the clinic and let them know if they have any symptoms. I do think that even if patients have symptoms, you know, I don't know if refusing them care is, and it doesn't sound like that's what you're doing. I know that that has happened in some places is the way to go, but I think just having a protocol on what to do if somebody screens positive, you know, how would your clinic handle that, I think might help alleviate some of the stress there. But in terms of the screeners, you know, I think that is something that you should feel empowered to make a decision on based on what would make people feel most comfortable.
Thank you so much. We do have a shortage of PPE, and that is part of the problem because I have recommended myself that the screeners go ahead with mask. And so it's most of all because of our shortage. So, okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Once again, for any questions, please press star 1. The next question comes from Janelle Riley. Janelle, your line is open. Go ahead. Oh, she canceled her question request. As a reminder, if you have any questions, please press star 1. Dr. Keaton, at this moment, we show no further questions.
Okay, we're happy to stay on the line to see if anything rolls in for a few more minutes.
And this is Wendy at PHA. Just want to thank you all so much over at Health for jumping on this call every week. I know that our members really appreciate it.
We have a follow-up question. It's from the team on the West Tennessee Healthcare.
Yes. Hey, Dr. Keaton, this is Cindy again. Just to kind of clarify what our process is, and then you tell me what you feel about this, we are using every alternative gown that we can, but and right now we don't have any confirmed cases on our COVID floor. We have 20 PUIs. So what would be your thoughts on that process as far as doing the extended wear?
So we can certainly follow up after the call. I mean, I think if, especially if you don't have confirmed COVID-19 patients, I think it would be really hard to make an argument of going from room to room in the same gown, unless you're doing just low contact activities. You know, I think if you're truly within 6 feet of the patient and wearing a gown, I would worry from an infection prevention and control standpoint about going into another patient room in that situation. But we can certainly talk more offline.
Thank you.
We received a question from an unidentified participant. If your phone number begins with area code 212, please go ahead with your question. We ask that you also state your name prior to stating your question.
Aaron Barber, had a friend. I'm at the theater here in town, and they sort of did an inventory in the basement, and I found boxes of masks. They're industrial masks, but they have an N90-something designation. So.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Thank you. Your line is open. If you have a question, please go ahead.
I heard some talking in the background about people finding some industrial masks. I will point out if anyone hears of groups or organizations that have PPE that they want to sort of systematically donate for redistribution to healthcare facilities across the state, if you go to our website, which again will include on the link, there is an email address. It's covid.ppedonations@tn.gov. Again, that's covid.ppedonations@tn.gov. People can send an email to that. That's routed through the folks that are organizing all of the logistics of this at TEMA to ensure that that is collected and then redistributed appropriately to folks across the state. So that could be helpful if what I overheard was meant to be a question.
Thank you. We have a question from Dr. Brown. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Follow-up for Dr. Johns on the TEMA and distributing of PPE, just so for clarity so I understand. We are to go through our local emergency management / National Guard folks to access that, the request to go up to TEMA, and not to go through our local healthcare coalitions? Was that accurate in what you said?
Hey, Dr. Brown, this is Dr. Phil. Dr. Jones had stepped out.
Okay.
Yeah, so let me... I've briefly seen the flowchart diagram. Let me confirm. You know, I think so we sort of have two different piles of PPE. So the material that came through the SNS was distributed. The Strategic National Stockpile was distributed to the coalitions.
Right.
I think then TEMA is gathering sort of other miscellaneous donations that they're hearing about. That, you know, is sort of rolling in a continuous basis, and so it's harder to systematically distribute it to the coalitions because we have no idea how much there's going to be and whatnot. And so there's been a prioritization list that's been created based on some ASSO and HHS documentation. And so that's why for sort of this other potential stockpile, I believe going through your emergency management agency is the appropriate route because there's just no way for us to ensure that it's systematically and evenly distributed to all of the coalitions because of how it's being collated, if that makes sense.
All right. So if anything else comes from the national stockpile, it will still come through the healthcare coalition distribution channels, and anything else that's donated goes through TEMA.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Once again, for any questions, please press star 1.
Well, again, I think, go ahead.
We received just one more question. We ask that you please state your name prior to stating your question. Perhaps you can get closer to the phone. We're not able to hear you.
Hi, this is Janelle Riley. Can you hear me now?
We can.
I was curious if the state has thought about standing up some alternate care sites for the nursing home patients to be held, if that is a possibility, if other states are doing something like that.
Yeah, I may actually defer to Dr. Long to answer this question. There's a whole separate working group through TEMA and some of our logistics folks, as well as representatives from the Tennessee Hospital Association and some hospitals around the state that are starting to have discussions about alternative care sites. I'm not a part of all those conversations, but Dr. Long, do you have any comments about where that process is or what the discussions have been?
Yeah, I can share a little bit. I think that part of what they're thinking about in terms of standing up these alternative care sites is, I don't know that it would necessarily be labeled nursing home patients, but patients who are not in need of really aggressive treatment, ICU level care, but who are not quite ready to go to home or potentially a nursing home, or maybe they would be ready to go to a nursing home, but, you know, we are in this difficult time where it can be sometimes difficult to get a nursing home to accept a patient. So I do think, as I was listening to that conversation about the nursing homes and difficulty getting them to take patients back, that these kinds of alternative care sites could potentially fill that void. I think the focus at this point is on likely putting those in metropolitan areas working with the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA around their abilities to actually bring up a physical location like that. Big question of how we staff it. Just starting to have conversations about developing some kind of pool of healthcare workers that could potentially be tapped from parts of the state that aren't necessarily experiencing a surge to come in to staff that sort of location. Also, honestly, had a conversation this morning with some hospitals about, is that the right approach? Is it to try to move healthcare workers from other parts of the state, or should we be thinking about potentially moving patients to full-service hospitals that aren't experiencing a surge? So still an awful lot under discussion, but yes, those kinds of things are being looked at.
Thank you. And as a reminder, if you have any questions, please press star 1. Dr. I show no further questions.
All right, well, thanks again from the Tennessee Department of Health for everyone's hard work, and thanks to THA for hosting these calls. We hope it's a helpful time for people to be able to ask questions and hopefully get at least some helpful answers. We'll follow up by email with a list of the resources that we mentioned on the call today. And as always, if there are other needs or questions that arise, please don't hesitate to reach out through THA to us, and we're happy to help however we can.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen.
You can go ahead and disconnect, operator.
Thank you. With this, we conclude today's conference. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.